Your Honor, Abby.
Gentlemen, ready to roll. Today is February 7th, 2011. And here we are in Yerushalayim HaKodesh with the whole world in turmoil. And thank God we can sit back and put ourselves into turmoil. First of all, I just want to make one correction on my shiur yesterday. I realized I made a mistake. I spoke to you about at the end with the Jewish community that was established by the Baron Hirsch Fund. It was Woodbine. I got confused. There was another. There was a Mount of Freehold, I think it was. That's why I went to visit a different friend of mine who was in the rabbinate, Rabbi Jerry Przanski, Zichrono Livracha. He died very young. Whenever I mention his name, my heart breaks. It's Rabbi Steve Przanski's uncle. And Jerry and I were very close friends. He was a musmach about 2 years or a year ahead of me in the yeshiva. And he went into the rabbinate in New Jersey. And I used to visit him and Bernie Cohn. But it was Bernie Cohn who was in Woodbine, which was the Baron de Hirsch. Exactly what I told you was correct. It was established in 1891. Had an Orthodox shul. And all that was done with the idea that Aliyah's not the answer, Israel, Palestine is depressed, who can build it, who can clear the swamps, certainly the Jews cannot, and they established a number of colonies like Woodbine. So everything else I told you was correct, but I just want to correct the location. I also want to mention, when we spoke about, I'll tie this in a minute to the Shayurim. So what have we been speaking about? We spoke about the swing to the left, and I showed you areas that greatly disturbed me. I'll come back to it, if not today, next week. And after watching the conservative movement for 110 years, or 109 years, since Solomon Schacht arrived in America, we certainly have to be apprehensive about what's happening in the left element of the so-called Orthodox world. But then I said, a lot of people claim there has been a swing to the right, and certain things have happened which have bothered them, disturbed them. And I want to make the point, and I made it last week on the Israeli scene today, I want to show you additional material. I don't believe anyone is more disturbed than Aaron Rakefet, that there's a swing to the right in the Haredi world. I showed you last week many areas where I consider Haredim, pardon me, Reformed Jews, pshuto kamashmao. And you don't have to be a great London to understand to oppose a core curriculum is opposing an open Gemara and Kedushin and opposing all of what Yiddishkeit is about, the self-respect that a human being has to have. To be opposed to serving the Israeli army is literally, it borders way beyond Amratzah, because the Gemara in Saita, the Rambam, Hilchot Malachim, Milchemet Mitzvah, the Yenlanu Milchemet Mitzvah, Yotegid Olad, and the Milchemet Mitzvah we're caught up with right now. And that too represents to me Reform of Judaism, a retroactive annulment of Geirut, as I showed you. It's a reflection of Rabbi Rachman, a retroactive annulment of marriage. We have halachic problems. I answered Michael yesterday. He said to me, yes, you want to set standards, higher standards. I'm not opposed to higher standards, but it has to be set lachat chila. You can't come 10, 20, 30, 100 years later. If you would know how many students I have taught whose grandparents, great-grandparents converted and were not from, and these kids are lamdanim and sadikim, and what, the conversion was not chal, and I discussed this with the Rav, and I'm the law maratan ochi b'tchum hazeh. And you can't allow, you hate the tzioni dati world, but you can't allow that to influence your halachic thinking. And unfortunately, we've seen it, and I can give you many more reasons. I showed you this whole concept, this whole preoccupation with women, with tzniut, is absolutely not healthy. A man is a man, a woman is a woman, thank God a man is a man, thank God a woman is a woman. I don't have to tell you, I quoted Chazal, I went through this in great detail a year ago perhaps. If we wouldn't have the sexual tension, none of us would get married. And I can tell you a little secret. I see students of mine grow older and older, and I meet people, And believe me, once the hormones calm down, no one's running to get married. They're so used to being themselves, so they won't have children. So they're like Benazai. They can find a thousand and one justifications. And this preoccupation, ad kedekach, not to mention a woman's first name, to me it borders on chilul Hashem, no ra. I showed last week a lot worse, if you recall. And Ribbono Shel Olam, Yitzchok was a big sinner. He reads the Torah, he reads Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah, right or wrong, Tzipora, Devorah, Miriam, Oyvei, Yitzchok, you're reading names of women. And this is abnormal. It's against Torah, it's against...
What about women seeing the
human decency, etc. Okay, say that. If you're going to tell the stories, the Chofetz Chaim and Reb Meir Shapiro. What Yitzchak is referring to was that the Lidlina Rav, who came from a... Look, I got into a lot of trouble years ago and I had no idea what the internet was. And one time I walked in after class, I had a lot more energy than I was 15, 20 years younger. So after class, I would deal with contemporary issues and speak for another 45 minutes. So one time I'd been in, today I have a policy when I'm invited to a wedding, if it's separate seating, I don't stay for the meal. It's a given. Alright? So if I'm going to stay for a meal, I want to sit with my wife, I don't want to sit and talk Lashon Hara with a bunch of men. So I spoke about separate seating and all the halachas, and I dealt with the Raman, I dealt with the Levush, and I dealt with the whole problem and the subjective influence. And I said, when a Gera Chassan invites me, I said, the touchstone is, how do you sit Friday night in your house? If you sit Friday night in your house, men and women together, you consider the wedding men and women together. That's the based upon the Lepush. But I said, Gera Chassidim, who have a very, pardon me, perverted attitude towards sex, and it affects them. They lose... I don't know if I mentioned here, mentioned elsewhere. If you read Yediot a year and a half ago, there was a whole article on two Gera Chassidiyot who, boy, are far from base Jacob girls today, as I said yesterday. And of course, Yediot Achrono jumped on it with glee. So Gera Chassidim, the men and women sit separate in their own homes Friday night. So when I'm invited to a Gera Simcha, I know that the men and women are going to be in separate rooms. And I've been at Gera Smachot where the Rebbetzin was there and the Rebbe was there. And mommy's separate rooms. Okay, but if you eat mix, so at a wedding, what's wrong? Anyway, so got a lot of comments ranging. Rakepit is the greatest tzaddik in the generation, the only man who speaks the truth, ranging all the way to a middle point of view that Rakepit is a tzaddik. He can sit with women, but other men sit with women, and all they think about is seducing them. I couldn't believe what I'm seeing. And I want to make clear, if men sit with women and all they think about is seducing him, put the men in a cage and put the women 10 miles away. I'm the greatest believer in Torah. And if that's the way men are, a bunch of animals, lock them up and send them out to pasture in South Africa. And then I got comments that I'm a Russia Marusha, that this, and everyone sits separate, and suddenly they forgot that the Chofetz Chaim sat with his wife for Friday night. And what's the story? It's the famous story. The Maram Lublin, who's one of the great Jews of the 20s into the 30s, the man who popularized the Daf Yomi, the man who established Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin, and he wrote a letter to the Chofetz Chaim that he's going to be traveling, he's going to spend the Shabbos in Raten. And he'll spend the Shabbos in Raten, he would like to come to be the Chofetz Chaim's guest. So the Chofetz Chaim said absolutely. Then he found out that the Chofetz Chaim's family sits mixed. So he wrote to the Chofetz Chaim that would he mind if the Friday night he's there, they would separate the sexes. And the Chofetz Chaim wrote him back, he's not allowed to do that. Al pi halacha, he said, he wrote a ketubah and he gave his wife, and in the ketubah it promises the husband will treat the wife properly, and part of treating her properly, it's an open mishnah, a shabbos, has to sit with you and be with you, etc., etc. So that's the story Yitzchak is referring to.
Was it also
Smiris? Smiris is a different story. That's a story with Rav Tights. That's the famous story, Rabbi Rabbi Prale, Rabbi Teitz. That's a story, let it be. There are many different versions, but the version I believe is that Rabbi Teitz warned the guest rabbi that the girls would be singing Zmirat and not the walk out like some other rabbi did, because it would offend his children and his grandchildren. Okay, be it as it may, I want to show you now why I should be furious and angry at the right-wing world. And I have every reason in the world. I'm holding a volume that just came out, Rabbi Scherer, published by one of Otsko's subsidiaries. It's the Otsko History Series, published by Masora, authored by Jonasson Rosenblum. So when I heard that research was being done on the book, I thought to myself, well, someone's going to give me a call and interview me. Why should they interview me? What does Aaron Rakefet have to do with Rabbi Moshe Scherer? Well, anyone who does research, number one, has to turn up my second book, which may be my most famous, my work on Reb Lazer Silva, which has gone through 3 editions. It's more in the Haredi world than the YU world, because the YU world basically has no idea who Reb Lazer Silva was. But the Haredi world, of course, knows the name Reb Lazer Silva. And wherever I go and meet Haredim, they all tell me how much they enjoyed the volume, etc., etc. Now, when you write about Reb Lazer Silva, you have to write about Agudat Yisrael. And I believe, if you're familiar with my work on Reb Lazer, I did my spade work, I did my research, and I wrote about Agudat Yisrael. So, number one, they have to contact me on that level. Much more important, everyone in the higher echelon of Agudat Yisrael and in the archives, they will find that Aaron Rakefet and Reb Moshe Scherer were extremely close. The story is a magnificent story. It's worthy of a movie, and it all begins with Russian Jewry. And I'll tell you the story very briefly in a few minutes. And how can you do research on Rabbi Moshe Scherer without counting Aaron Rakefet? As a matter of fact, when this book came out, and a student of mine, or students of mine, went to Rabbi Scherer's home, I believe his name, Rabbi Scherer's son, I believe his name is Rabbi Shimshon Scherer, you can correct me if I'm wrong, went to his son, who has a shtibble in Borough Park, and you know, works, and quite, I understand, a wonderful individual. And how can it be that Rabbi Rakefet was not mentioned? He took out a tabletop coffee book, they called it, am I pronouncing it right? A coffee tabletop, what's the expression? Coffee tabletop book. Give me the right.
Without the top.
Coffee table. Excuse me, forget about the top. The table just lost its top. A coffee table book that has. It's a big book they put out, and they have in there about Reb Moshe Scherer, about his life, and they have endless pictures of correspondence, and in there they show that there's correspondence with Aaron Rakefet. And they were shocked. And I, all right, they didn't contact me, didn't interview me. Maybe they worked in the archives. The book came out, and on one hand, the absolute lack of scholarship. But more than that, deceit, falsehood, and ultimately idiocy. Right here in this book. If anyone has a reason to be angry, let me show you what I'm talking about. Let me fill you in on W. Yadua L'Rabim, very important. Page 41 talks about Rabbi Scherer's background and speaks about the family. Anyone reading it understands right away that the family was not too religious. He had 2 full brothers from his mother's and father's, I don't know, both, second marriage. Maybe his father's second marriage, his mother's first. You have to read the book. 2 full brothers, Harry 6 years older And Ruby 3 is old and preceded Moshe into the world. That's the only mention of the brothers. Now, the truth of the matter is that anyone writing about Harry Sharonel has to tell you about the brothers. Ruby went on to become a businessman. He worshipped, may I use the term, in a conservative temple. Harry, who I knew intimately at a very formative stage in my life, he was the English principal of the day school I attended, Yeshiva Rabbi Israel Salanta, Torah Vadas graduate, went on to become a Reform rabbi. As far as I know, Harry is still alive today. I corresponded with him in preparing the book, my new book. I was amazed to see that a man in his 80s into his 90s still writes the exact penmanship. I have letters from the 1940s from Harry Scherer. I don't want to comment more. Everyone is free in life to choose to be a Mechalel Shabbos, free in life to be Boel, Bilat Asurat. My only problem was I saw this at a very early stage in life when I was developing hormones, and what a shocking, traumatic experience. Okay, if you mention the brothers, you have to write and explain that this was the era. You could go to Torah Vadas and come out of it a Reform rabbi, and you can check every word I'm saying, Google Rabbi Harry Scherer. I can tell you more stories, but it's not for the microphone, it's not in public, and I don't want to disgrace my lips. But if you mention the brothers, you have to mention the struggle. His mother, who was a tzaddiket, evidently, from what I hear, from what I read, from what I read about in the Mike Tress book by the same author, I hope the facts are right, that she and Michael Tress's mother, who were sisters, were Moisrois Nefesh, and at least one child remained from that was the youngest. And of course, he grew up in a different period when it was easier to remain from. He already benefited from the refugee influx of World War II. So that was the background, the family where Moshe Scherer comes from. Why am I telling you this? It becomes very important in a few minutes. Then you talk about the founding of Agudat Yisrael. It is beyond words what this author writes. He writes, he doesn't tell the story at all. The story is legendary. Rakepet has documented it. I have said it in public before. Hundreds of thousands of people over the generations. People have quoted me and quoted me. And the story is beautiful. Agudat Yisrael, they organized it, as we know Agudat today, in 1919. I'll be giving lectures on Agudat Yisrael, if not this term, next term, Be'ezrat Hashem. It was organized basically after World War I as a living organization. I'm weighing every word I'm saying, Josh. Danny, they tried to organize it in America in the 1920s. It didn't really succeed because people who came to America, the fact that you came to America, even if you wanted to remain from, but you were more open-minded. And Mizrahi was your cup of tea. After World War I, as we will see, Mizrahi went on the map, and Mizrahi was your cup of tea, not Agudat Yisrael. The 1930s came in, and Agudat Yisrael was as active in America as a dead Chinaman is trying to learn Shas in his grave. But then, as you recall, by the late 30s, a new element came to America. And this element was the first element coming to America, not because they wanted to save their lives, not because they wanted to better their lives, but because they wanted to save their lives. When my grandparents came to America, and Nachum's grandparents came to America, they knew very well the chances were that their children and grandchildren would be Mechalalei Shabbos, Ochlein Avelet and Treifat, and every sin under the book. Period. And if you don't believe me, Nachum, check with your father. He is a truthful individual. But by the late 30s, when people ran to America, yes, when did your parents get to America?
1938.
Okay, so where were you born?
I I was born in Boston.
Ah, so you could be president of the United States. Good. You follow what I'm asking, Michael? He's right on the borderline, because I know how old he is. So when Yitz's parents came to America, they were coming to save their lives. And
they came from Palestine.
And there was a dedication. There was a dedication. No wonder you married Judy. You're a Palestinian, and she's a Palestinian. But there was a dedication to remain firm in America. What happened was, in 1937, the world, Agudat Yisrael, held its last Knesiyah Gedolah before Hitler. Without going into detail, the Knesiyah Gedolah was a great coming together of Jews from all over. Vasu kulam aguda achat lasot ritzon kongam. It gives you strength when Gedolah Yisrael sit together. And there was a Knesiyah Gedolah, if I recall correctly, 23, 29, and now 37, Marian Bar Czechoslovakia. By now, Rav Lezer Silva had conquered America. He was president of the Agudas HaRabbanim. He was the rabbi of Cincinnati. Rav Lezer, like all Gedolei Yisrael, money meant nothing to him. Ultimately, the congregation had to pay his wife, not him, because he could walk home from the shul with $100 in cash, having been paid his monthly salary, and he'd give it away to the first poor man who came over to him. But evidently he came up with enough money, and Reb Lezer led a delegation to the Knesiyah Gedolah. He was going back to Europe. He wanted to see, it's a healthy feeling, you want to go back to your roots. He wanted to see his Rebbeim, who was still alive. So before the Knesiyah, he detoured to Vilna, and he went to see his Rebbe, Reb Chaim Oizer Gershinsky, the great Rav Gershinsky, the Rav of Vilna, the Achi Ezer. Went to see the Rav of Vilna, and the Rav of Vilna said to him, "Mein Talmud Lezer, ich denke, dass ich in Zeit, dass man darf gründen, an a gutes Yisrael in Amerika." Translation: "My Talmud Eliezer, I think the time has come to establish an Agudat Yisrael in America." That's all Reb Lezer Silva had to hear. He went back, he got to work, 1938, he held the first Agudat Yisrael convention, Dafka in Cincinnati, where all the Reform Jews are, where Hebrew Union College is. And they went crazy. Shtreimels were all over the place. Rebbeim had now come to America. Rebbe Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik came down to Cincinnati. Everyone was there. The Reform press went crazy. They called it a Shtreimel convention. The streets of Cincinnati were desecrated by the Shtreimels, by the Kapatas, etc., etc. Agudat Yisrael begins its humble beginnings in America. When Reb Chaim Meiser dies, you all recall that Mori Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, gave the unbelievable chesed for Reb Chaim Meiser Gershinsky at the Agudah Convention in 1940 or 41. It was right after, you have to look into the Suvir to get the exact date. It may have been the 40. And right after Reb Chaim Meiser died, because he died in August, and I believe the convention was after Sukkot. But look,
before the war?
He died right before the war, 1940. I write about it, both in Revel and in Selva, and in the Rakhapurah.
The war started September 39. Yeah, the Russians had already...
No, we died before America entered the war. He already was in Vilna with Lithuania, the whole story, you know, independent Lithuania. He died when I believe... There was the communist takeover already, right? If independent Lithuania...
The Russians are still there.
The Russians had just taken over, and that's when he died of cancer. I have details in Rakhapur Aharon, I have a monograph on the Chaim Meiser. It's been republished a number of times. People asked me permission to republish it. I absolutely said yes with a capital Y. And he died, and the Rav gave an unbelievable hesped, which Agudistim call it. It's a more agudist outlook than agudah of today. That's before the Rav became a Mizrahi Aitor. It was at a period when he was still committed to his concepts of an agudist, and it's before the Mizrahiite gradual change in the Rav's life. Now, That's the way Agudat Yisrael began, and I don't have to tell you after World War II it became a major organization. Ultimately, Agudat became so big and so important and so right-wing with the American swing to the right that Reb Lazer Silver became persona non grata in Agudat Yisrael. And it's a sad story. And
in his lifetime?
Yeah, in his lifetime, of course. When Reb Lazer turned 75, the big celebration in honor of his birthday was not Agudat Yisrael, it was the Rabbinical Council of America that wined and dined him and fed him and held a big dinner in his honor, and that's where Reb Lazer got up and the famous speech that I quote, only Reb Lazer could talk this way, Yichen ha-Yerushalmim infekta shayla ish ha-kula kahanem rikit maliyas or behind in America ha-mi anander ish shayla ish ha-kula kanoyim. And the audience went berserk. Translation. Reb Lazer said, I know a Gemara, it's a whole Yishami, a whole question. If you have a city with only Kahanim, how do you work out the Aliyahs? But he says, in America today, we have a different question. It's an Ir Shekulo Kanoim, zealots. And the audience went berserk. And that was Reb Lazer at 75, with it and witty, and his eyes shining, and at the RCA, hitting the nail on the head. Now, when you read this book, you get the impression, how did Agudat begin from a little shul in Williamsburg? And here I'll give you a drop of background. I don't want to take anything for granted, but I lived this. I mean, I'm not lived it, but right afterwards, I know it from my own knowing all the many of the people involved. In America, the shuls, the Orthodox shuls. Yesterday, the editor questioned my use of the word cuspidor. She said she did not know what the word cuspidor meant.
Okay.
She had to look it up, so she suggested I use the word spittoon. I said, no, leave cuspidor, spittoon is too gross. How does a spittoon or a cuspidor come up in my scholarly memoir?
Yeah.
Very simple. Remember Rabbi Joseph H. Lichtstein? Lichtstein used to tell us, when I came to Gehillat Jeshurun, the first order of business, I insisted that the Balabatim have to get rid of the cuspidors. There were spittoons. I remember it myself. In the middle of davening, a guy would walk over and back, in the middle of davening, in the middle of Musaf. And Rabbi Lichtstein said the Balabatim fought him. For him to get rid of those cuspidors was an ongoing battle. It's a spittoon. Cuspidor is a nice word for spittoon. So you got to remember, the shuls had spittoons. Don't explain it. It's terrible. But not only did they have spittoons, the whole shul was depressing. A kid wasn't allowed to daven from Amid. The old timers davened, the upkid davened, didn't know what they were saying. It's a little under 100 years ago, Young Israel was organized. Young Israel was organized, basically, Young Israel was a shoot-off from the seminary crowd. The seminary crowd at that time had all what you would call modern Orthodox people, and they wanted a shul where the youth would feel at home. So that in Young Israel, you had no cuspidors, you had singing, davening was nice, kids led the service, you didn't have talking, you had a sermon in English, everything centered around making the shul, to use a homiletic word that we were taught, user-friendly. Now,
wasn't Mordechai Kaplan
was involved, absolutely, and there were more people from the seminary, and there were some East Side people, and Young Israel still awaits a definitive history. No one, to the best of my knowledge, has published a definitive history of the first 25 years of Young Israel. It would be a fascinating doctorate.
And Young Israel would never publish it.
Well, today, the Young Israel would never publish it, but a doctorate can be done at a university beyond the reaches of censorship.
This book is written by Jonathan Rosenblum?
Yeah.
Better known as Jonathan Rosenblum.
Jonathan
Rosenblum.
Here he's from. His name is Jonathan Rosenblum. Yeah. I know him. I can't believe that he wrote on a level like this. Anyway, so in Williamsburg, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman visited America in 1938. All of you know his visit was really the impetus for the yeshiva swing to the right. In his visit, he absolutely maledicted what today is Yeshiva University. He refused to give a shiur there. He went to Mr. Manischewitz, the son of the founder, a frum man, Reb Tzvi Hirsch Manischewitz, and gave him a list of classes being taught in Yeshiva College that were absolute apikurset. And he told Mr. Manischewitz and others they have to stop their support of Yeshiva and Yeshiva College. It is a nest of heresy. You will know how this reflects in the Suva era. I publish a letter, I have it in my archives, in Rebbe Chanan's handwriting, so no one can say it's false, where a kid has a chance to come to America as a student visa to save his life, to go to Yeshiva University, and Rebbe Chanan tells him not to go. He'll die spiritually. Better to die physically than to die spiritually. And he says the only way to save your life by going to America is to go to Tera B'das. Now, with this type of thinking, Rebbe Chanan had a tremendous influence on a group of youngsters in Williamsburg. I believe that's where he stayed. I believe it was with the Herman family. And these kids gathered around him. And they organized, or they took over a shul, or there was a shul, and they now called it Pirchei Agudah, in contradistinction to Young Israel. In other words, the Young Israel of Williamsburg has the more modern element, the YU element, the Torah Mader element, call it by whatever terminology you know it, the Mizrahi element, but we're going to have a Pirchei Agudah. And that was a little shul that had no influence whatsoever on the greater scene. It was limited to Williamsburg, and it was a shul where Moshe Sherrod davened, where Michael Tress davened, where very fine, good, wonderful people davened. If you read Jonas and Rosenblum's work, you get the feeling that out of that shul, that's how Agudat Yisrael in America developed. Late din, the late dayan. It has no relationship whatsoever. Agudat Yisrael as a national movement with Reb Lazer Silva, one dynamo who was turned on by his Rebbe. And once Reb Chaim Meisser said to him, being done a good Israel in America, he had the right people already. The Biyana Rebbe was in America. The Rav was in America. Reb Moshe Feinstein has just arrived in America. He had the right people. And he had the yeshiva people. And he had the Hasidish people. And people were pouring in to save their lives. And that's how a good Israel began. Now I'm going to show you something amazing. You open up to page 86, and there's a picture of Reb Lazer Silva at the 1941 convention. So that's when, evidently, Moriah Rebbe eulogized the Reb Chaim Meisser. And it shows you seated the Novorinsky Rebbe, the Biyana Rebbe, Reb Moshe Feinstein, and then it adds on to the picture, three sentences. Rabbi Silva established the American Agudah in the late 1930s at the behest of his Rebbe, Rabbi Chaim Isaac Rosinsky, upon returning from the Third Knesset Gedolah in Marienbad. He served as the organization's president. What's going on here? Ribbono Shel Olam. This requires a whole chapter, a whole story. What does this have to do with the picture? How do you come in after telling a whole story with the beginning and the tziri and the shul and Williamsburg? You know what I was told? I don't want to mention the name. Someone very big in Agudat Yisrael read the manuscript and read Rosenblum, the Riot Act. How can it be? Why didn't you cite Rav Rakefet? The facts are all there. And this is an addendum he made at the very end. After he was told off, put in these 2.5 sentences with the picture. How do I know this? Very simple, because the pictures, I just signed off on the book yesterday. It's finished. They don't have any more editors. I just checked. I called up Geffen this morning. to check with the coordinator. Thank God, I've now gone through three different editings of the book. Rabbi Gil's student, and two editings here, the middle one David was involved with, and yesterday, all alone, dealing with the senior editor. And I told you, I was blown away by that lady's knowledge. Wow. We have an overflow of talent in the Anglo-American Torah community in Yerushalayim. We have the best of the world here. People who come in Aliyah, and you, anyone listening in the Golah can be upset at me and mad at me and angry at me. You will not budge me, Kehuza. The finest people come in Aliyah, and they're on an unbelievable level. And the book is finished, edited. What's not done? What comes afterwards? The pictures. The Rav, what came afterwards? The pictures. I remember with the corrections for volume two pictures, Bernie Sharpstein says to me, Aaron, depend upon me, I'll make the corrections. I'm like an idiot. I said, fine, I'll depend upon you. The first printing of the Rav, every picture in volume two, there's a typo. There's a mistake. But the pictures come last. The Suva era, Rabbi Revel, the pictures come last. He made this addendum. Okay, so fine. He neglected my book. He didn't see my book. He wasn't interested in my book. He didn't want to touch my book. Rakepit is a Zionist. Rakepit is a YU person. Rakepit is a tzaddik, a gon, he's this, he's that. But he is soiled because he is one who believes in a living God and not in Maisa Sutton. Baruch Hashem.
Okay. Trying to do this because
Cheryl
is from Williamsburg? Is he trying to tie it together?
He describes, he davened in that minion. It's fine. He has a right to describe
the
minion.
He's trying to inflate the importance of it.
Oh, inflate. He created. Didn't just inflate. It's a local minion. Not, in other words, you like a kid today, you'll boast. I go to KBY. I don't go to Torah Shriver. Place KBY from a better, I don't know. I go to KBY. I go to Shalavim. Oh, another. The Gush, you understand? Every kid has to find his place. For certain kids, KBY is the best place. The Gush is the best place. Certain kids, it's a chaval, they didn't go to Torah Tracker. I know certain kids went to the famous yeshiva, they round up a don't ask, drunkards, drug addicts, etc., etc. Had they gone to Torah Tracker, they would be tzaddikim. I know what I'm saying. You know, not every place. You have to know the BMT. There were certain kids. You know, anywhere else they would have been lost. BMT, a Rebbe, had influence. There was that interaction. There was the Super Bowl. Moshe Horowitz would get up in front of the whole island, give them the results of the Super Bowl. The kids would commit hari-kari because Moshe didn't know those that this is before instant communication, not like today. But the Plaza Hotel, a day after the Super Bowl, had a video delivered of the Super Bowl by El Al Plain. And they showed it for $20. You had beer and pretzels and soda. And imagine Reb Moshe thinks he's doing the kids a favor. Monday morning, he tells them after davening, I'm very happy to tell you, the Steelers lost one. The Green Bay Packers won. Am I right? The Green Bay Packers won. What went on yesterday? Help me out. Baruch Hashem. So,
I just won by 6 points.
All right, believe me, I'm a baseball fan, but I know the Super Bowl is wow. So you understand? A kid like that in BMT, the Rebbe knows baseball. Wow. Gentlemen, all this is nothing.
Did you ever communicate with Jonas?
There's nothing to communicate. He never contacted me. I'm communicating now. I'm speaking to the whole world. Say that. I can't believe. But this is nothing. Now we're coming in to where I have every reason in the world to be furious and angry and let it affect my spiritual gestalt. Gentlemen, I have one mitzvah that no one in this building has. Rabbi Miller will certify it. The branch of the Mossad will bring up the people from the grave. They will certify. And all this is in great detail in my new book. It's very important. When I came back, my wife and I came back from Russia the first time. So we were overwhelmed. Yitzhak can understand what I'm saying. You go crazy. If you're a Jew, Saturday, Friday night, there's a balabas, a former president of a big Orthodox shul, and he has it in for rabbis. I have no idea. Whenever I'm always at his house, and he's always maledicting rabbis, and if I defend rabbis, he tries to put me down. And, you know, if you're a Jew, a rabbi, imagine you can go into the Warsaw ghetto and come out. You're overwhelmed. What can you do to help? You come out of Russia, you see wonderful Jews like you, like me. People who were there only because of the fall of the dice. Their uncle went to America, and as a result of that, the uncle's children were my students in Michola, BMT, and the first cousin who remained in Israel winds up in prison three times, Joseph Begun, for teaching Torah and teaching Aleph Bet. And
remained in Russia.
Remained in Russia. Right. What did I say? Remained in America. I hope I'm wrong. Remained in Israel. Remained in Russia. So I taught Joseph Begun's first cousin at Michalah. First cousin once removed. Two brothers. One stayed. One went to America. Some stayed in Europe because Rabbanim told them not to go to America. Your kids won't be thrown. Take a look what happened, what remained of the Soloveitchik family, the Feinstein family, the Kamenetsky family. Shem Yirachem. So when we got out, we started working for Russian Jewry on three different levels. One level, and the level I want to talk about, is a very simple level. Malka and I made up our minds we have to do everything to get the Essas family out. He was a family in refusal at that time, something like eight, nine years. And they have three children. And there's now a whole support community that can take over. There's a lot of youth in refusal that has become Shomer Shabbat. And we were overwhelmed by the personality of Anya and Elia Essas. The boss, whose name I was never allowed to mention, the man who headed up this desk in Nativ, which was part of the Israeli intelligence community, a shoot off from the Mossad originally, Aryeh Kroll, Zeichet Tzadik Livracha, Aryeh said to me, 1980, briefing me, says to me, Harav Rakefet, you will not be the same person after you've met Elia Essas. And I said to Malka afterwards, Aryeh Kroll knows what the heck he's speaking about. I sat at the foot of the Rav. I spoke in learning with Reb Aaron Kotler, with Reb Moshe Feinstein, with Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. I'm going to be impressed by some dummy in Moscow. Let me tell you, when I came out, I said to Aryeh Kroll, Ani chayav lecha Levakesh Slicha Mechila Ta'iti Atatsa Dakta Anilo. We were never the same again. So Malka and I went to work. Now, how do you get a family out of Russia? This is little Ani Rothkopf from the Bronx taking on the communist empire. So I started to function on ultimately two different levels. On one level, we organized a committee consisting of Malcolm, myself. Feldheim did all our printing gratis. I have to thank Rev Yaakov Feldheim. We came up with a fact sheet about the SS family with their picture. I have copies of it. I can make copies for everyone. It's in the office. And I started to contact senators. And I learned quickly. I got help from my student, Malcolm Holmlein, who then was the head of the New York Council of Jewish Relations, if I have it properly. Later goes on, as you know, the most famous lay Jewish leader today, the President's Conference. He is the executive director. Malcolm Holmlein was my student and my rabbin in Philadelphia when I gave a shiur once a week for the U of P students, and he would come. I have a picture of myself teaching Malcolm. Malcolm briefed me, and I learned very quickly, you can reach any senator. He'll do whatever you want, as long as you have the people as the intermediaries who give him money and support him. And I uncovered Jews who knew the most famous senators in America. And I corresponded with them. And every senator has an aide for human rights, at least at that time, I don't know today. But human rights was a big issue because of the communist empire. And every senator knew what to do and who to contact. And I got to the State Department. And I even found out I can reach governors with ease. They're anxious to get a picture with some Jews into the local press. It helps election time. And then I started to see that all we would get were form letters in response from the State Department, from the Russian ambassador to the United States at that time, Dubrinin, from the Russian foreign minister, Gromyko. So then my mind went further. I got to contact people who know how to play this game, not on the simple level, but on a deeper level. And I asked around in the Russian refusnik community in Israel, and they told me there's no better askan, klautu, I don't know how to say it in English, than Rav Moshe Sherer. I raised money. I was poorer than a church mouse at this time. It's still the outfall of the Yom Kippur War. I literally did not have money for the fourth Shabbat of the month for food. And I have two full jobs, but the jobs are on the books. I don't want to elaborate, or Mas Hakasa will call me in to testify what was going on here 30 years ago. No one but no one gave you a receipt. Taila Hakima. But I couldn't, I'm teaching for the Israeli government as one paycheck, and the Jewish agency was the other one. The Kollel paid me laughable. It's nothing but nothing. So, my friends put together money for a ticket, and I got to New York that summer. Malka let me go alone. I slept on a mattress on the floor of some student's joint, and I made an appointment from Israel before I went with Rav Moshe Sherer. My daughter had just graduated Michala, and my in-laws, Zichrono Levracha, brought her to America to spend part of the summer with them as a gift for graduating college, having a bachelor's. The meeting with Rav Moshe Sherer, I asked my eldest daughter, Taina, come with me, it should be interesting, and I might need some psychological support. We go to the meeting, I come in, there's Rav Moshe Sherer. Sitting next to him is his dear friend, long time on Gudetz, Rav Chatzko Besser, a book has been written about him, the rabbi in 84th Street. I imagine Rav Chatzko Besser was there because, as Rav Moshe Sherer says, I'll tell you in a second, they checked me out, and Rav Chatzko Besser's brother was married to my door-to-door neighbor's sister, Rav Chaim Friedman's sister, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Rav Chatzko just died this past year, I believe. His brother's brother-in-law died 6 years ago. The Yahrzeit is this week. And they're sitting there, and Rav Moshe Sherer says to me, I quote word by word, "Harav Rakepet, we checked you out. We know that you're a Gaon, a Tzaddik, and the last religious Zionist." Now, I have to tell you, this is a slap in your face. I say to him, right there, my daughter later asked me what happened. I say to him, "Rabbi Sherer, I'm not a Gaon, I'm not a Tzaddik. I try to be. But in your office, I am certain I am the last religious Zionist. By the way, Rabbi Sherer, I know your brother Harry very well. He was my principal in Solanta, and he almost ruined my life for Torah." Immediately, Rav Moshe's attitude changes. My daughter asked me later, when we came downstairs, it was 5 Beekman Street, downtown New York. It's not there anymore, I believe they moved. And
the Lower East Side.
Yeah, well, it's not the Lower East Side. It's Chinatown. It's like Mamish near 9. Where are they today? They're on Broadway.
What year was this meeting?
1981.
What office was this?
I'm sorry. The Agudat Yisrael office. And I told my daughter, look, he said to me, you're a Mizrachist. He was trying to say to me, du bist Ashekens. I let him know, don't be supercilious and haughty. I know your brother, the Reform Rabbi, very well. Believe me, I can tell him stories that I subsequently learned more stories about his brother. But I had enough to tell him then that would have, he would have paid me lo yachret skelt, if you know that expression. What's the word in English? Extortion money to keep it on. The opposite. Blackmail money. Not to tell what I know. And we became best of friends. I have to say that my relationship with Moshe Sherer was one of the high points of my life. I have to tell you, the man rose above any partisan feeling. And I have endless letters from him on mainly Russian topics, other topics. We corresponded. Whenever I was in America, I would go to see him afterwards with my wife. He was overwhelmed that my wife was as active as I was. Very, very impressed. And I told him, look, I came to talk to you about Russian Jewry. And I started to show him pictures I took in Moscow, Leningrad, Minsk, etc. And I showed him this picture. This picture will appear in the book. And it's a little group of refuseniks. I think it's 3 or 4. And I took the picture. If I wouldn't be a rabbi, I'd be a photographer. I took the picture. I caught them. They're going over the shir. I was teaching. In the book, I explained it. Avrei Psachim. And they're going over it. And he looks at the picture. And he says, you're working on me. What are you talking? This picture was taken in Kiryat Moshe. No, Kippat Srugat. They're learning. I said, Rabbi Sherem, look again, look at the Gemaras. They're ancient. They're pre-communist revolution. In Kiryat Moshe, they use new Gemaras. Look at the furniture. This is Russian, run-down, primitive furniture. And I have to give the man credit. His heart was like my heart. His soul like my soul. I'll never forget it. Suddenly his eyes opened. You're right. This is not Kiryat Moshe. Immediately called the secretary in, sent Reb Shmuel Blum, who was his assistant, went on to play a key role. I think he just retired. At that moment, Agudat Yisrael in America undertook unbelievable programs for Russian Jewry. The Vad Leman Nidachei Yisrael Mashu Kazad, the exact title in my book, Reb Mordechai Neustadt. I briefed him. He sent in people. Who briefed him? Who prepared? Did I do well? Did I do poorly? Yeah, if you're a Mizrahiite that thinks you have all the answers, Rakefet was a sinner. I got to go to Yisrael involved. And some of these people came out of Russia afterwards, Agudistan. If you have a different point of view, that everything done for Torah is fabulous, we got an entire world. Agudat Yisrael was later to pour tens of millions of dollars into their Russian operation. And it all began because of one religious Zionist nudnik named Aaron Rakefet. You can check every word I'm saying. Reb David Miller will certify, because he knew from afar. I was going back, I came back, I spoke, I was Meshuga Ledava Echad. Now, I have to tell you, and some of the correspondence will be published again. There's a limit, they want a limit. I gave them 165 pictures, including documents. I hope most of it will be published. We haven't yet fought this battle. I have a feeling the battle is coming up very soon, and I will once again enlist David Pardo's support. Danny, listen carefully. Reb Moshe went to work. He wrote to Senator Kennedy. He wrote to Dear Henry Kissinger, I have another mitzvah for you. He went to work, and these people got involved. Now, I have to say, He did wonders. He did not achieve the ultimate goal. I think everyone paved it and made it a little bit easier. I don't know. The Aaron Rakethet of the 80s, if you knew him, you'd be proud that you knew him. I am proud that I knew him. That's all I would tell you. He didn't stop. His mind kept on working. And I had a student in Michalah. She tells me her uncle is Izzy Singer, Rabbi Dr. Israel Singer, the executive director of the World Jewish Congress. Rumpman's right hand. And I have to say, this man sinned. Doesn't mention my name. I'll tell you what the story tells. You can, whatever little hair you have, you can rip out. Idiot. Nishke steigen, this is impossible. Anyone who was involved with Soviet juries, a gelechta. And Otsko publishes it. I went through with this book, three editors, each one ripping me apart, each one challenging me. You know what I'm saying? I'm mentioned Baruch Hashem because she spoke with Essas and was involved. I'm mentioned. Why do you come late? Okay, let me continue. We're nowhere.
Did Sherrod get involved in Russian jury?
Of course. He gets Sherrod. Hold on, Yitzchak. I haven't showed you the ultimate lie. You've heard nothing yet. That you slaughter a kefet mela.
So he did to you what Toynbee did to the Jews.
I'm in good shape. I'm coming out with a book with the facts, so believe me, I'm in good shape. Mendel will be proud of me. He'll call me a bright sting. Got it, Mendel? Okay. A little smile, please. Yehuda, listen carefully. So I asked this girl, I said, your uncle Zizi Singer, get me an appointment with him. I get an appointment with him. I come in. What can he do? As he sings a Torah Vadas Musbah. He's a PhD in English literature, I believe. He taught in Brooklyn College, and then he became this big executive director. I remember him telling me how he learns Daf Yomi no matter where he is in the world. So I tell him about this. He's going to do what he can. But, you know, I had the feeling he was trying to make me feel good. I have all this correspondence. About 1983, Bronfman is going to visit Russia with Izzy Singer. I contacted Izzy Singer. I said, you must visit Essas in Moscow. He visits Essas. From that moment on, he was working as hard as I was working. And the correspondence goes back and forth. I want to tell you, for Edgar Bronfman's cover and for Izzy Singer's cover, you know that I don't agree with Edgar Bronfman. I don't agree with rolling hand in hand with the reforming conservative. I have my own feeling. I'm not the one to say you can't have any cooperation, but there has to be a certain dignity that Torah is Torah. You all know that every year Gruss has to go with the reform, the conservative. I don't know what's happening this year. We get money from the Jewish Agency. So they went 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Edgar Bronfman spoke, and we have mixed marriages. We can't force people to convert, and we have to bring them closer to Judaism. He went and gave a whole tirade and gave out a book that everyone got his viewpoint on Judaism. Edgar Bronfman, who I don't think has learned the line of Gemara in his life, but Baruch Hashem, thank you. I have to give the man credit. I have to tell you, Izzy Singer was vilified in the press. You all know it came to a big blow up with Bronfman, that he went, I don't know exactly, he took money for his pension, and they accused him of going to fancy restaurants. Aaron Rakethet doesn't go to fancy restaurants. Aaron Rakethet hasn't raised, outside of Shvatami, I never raised a penny in my life. For Russian jury, I raised over the years millions of dollars. Fine. I don't go to. But if a man raises billions in reparations and he goes to a fancy restaurant, I would not criticize him. I gotta say to Issy Singer's credit, it is a story that should be told 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now, as long as the Jewish people walk the face of the earth. I got Issy Singer wound up. He wound up Bronfman. Bronfman was dealing, this is 1985, the end of the year. Stolchanaya, if I'm pronouncing it right, vodka. They were desperately looking for foreign currency. This is right before Chernobyl. It's a very difficult period. A lot of prisoners of Zion are being thrown into jail on a daily or weekly basis. And Edgar Bronfman is about to sign a $100,000 deal with them to sell their vodka all over the world as part of Seagram's. And he puts in one clause, the Essos family. Not only one clause, but he wants them out in time to address the next convention of the World Jewish Congress. Everything is in my book, all the details, every date. Friday, Erev Shabbos Parshat Toldot, 1986. I'm getting ready to go to the Kotel. Only my youngest daughter was still home. The phone rings. My daughter picks it up and says, Abba, Arya Kroll is on the phone. Arya Kroll? I start to shake. It's like the Rav calling me. There's no one I... The Rav is the greatest person I met in my life. Arya Kroll is a close second. Pick up the phone. Harav Rakechet, Hitzlachta, Anachnu Matzdiyim Lecha. Wow. My Hitzlachti. Head of this branch of
Okay.
He's written up, read about him in Yecheskel Levonon's book, Kol Nativ. He got Pras Yisrael, 202. Take out the newspapers, you don't have to read my book. Whatever I have in my book, but I have it a little better, more scholarly than the newspapers. And he tells me, the Essos family is getting out. Your contact with Bronfman did it. He says, we cannot believe it. Kol hakavod lecha. You know what that meant, to get a compliment like that from Arye Kroll? He said, Yom Rishon, Tetzalzel al Essos. Now you should know, as poor as I was calling Russia regularly, the Nativ, the branch of the Mossad, was paying for it. These calls were, because and you would get information on the phone, but the calls were fascinating. The operators, before today, you dial America 123. Danny's talking with his parents, his in-laws. Danny, here the operator, how to get the operator in Russia. So you have two operators. You had KGB agents, Mossad agents, and there were like six people breathing you could hear on the phone. So I call Essos Sunday. This is all recorded. I have a recording of this. I played it in my house. Elia and I were crying like babies. And I say to Elia, Elia, you see it, Mitzrayim, od ma'at chak ha-Pesach hagia b'shana haba. Shematal, you see it, Mitzrayim? He says to me, you see it, Mitzrayim? Mi v'mi ha-cholchim b'ne Binashenu, Vitapenu, Kola Mishpacha, Huameli, Odlo Shamati. I hang up, the conversation ends with Essos. I try to tell him there is some good news. The operator, when it's all over, she doesn't let me go off the line. The operator, the Jewish operator, from this side, the Israeli, that's okay. The operator says to me, Yesh besorah tovat, v'ani onel lo, lo, humoredly al tedak, tiyena besorah tovat. You should know, within 2 weeks, the Essos family, with the children, with Anya's parents, his parents were here already, were kicked out so quickly to meet the demand of Edgar Bronfman that he address the convention of the World Jewish That's the way the Essas family got out. I saved them, I would estimate, 18 months of torture. They would have gotten out by the end of 87, 88. The Iron Curtain fell. But Malker and I did it, and did it basically, you know, single-handedly. We were the committee, the August committee. The sheet looked so important, the committee for the release of the Essas family. Gentlemen, those are the facts. All the documents are a 10-second walk from here in the office of a Gris faculty member named, it says on the door, Harav Rakefet. My students built that sign, paid for that sign, designed that sign. They should have put a first name in. Your first name is more important than your last name. Harav Aharon Rakefet. Aharon, heavy mitam mitav shel Aharon. And you know what Pirkei Avot has to say. Gentlemen, are you sitting? This is how Essas gets out, according to this art scroll volume. The primary destination for the shluchim to the Soviet Union was the underground learning group in Moscow, headed by a brilliant young mathematician by the name of Eliyahu Essas. Essas was one of the numerous prisoners of Zion and refused Nix, including Yuli Elstein, Nachman Sharansky, whom Rabbi Shever attempted to help through his close contacts with former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and through Senator Edward Kennedy. Of course, at this point, he should have said that Rabbi Shever, the whole connection and the whole request to write to these people and tell the story of Aharon Rakefet, not a word. Essas was eventually freed in 1986. He was one of three names of prominent refuseniks on a list President Reagan presented the Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev at a summit in Geneva in November 1985. Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko, appropriately nicknamed Mr. Niet, Mr. No, looked at the list and told President Reagan he could have Essas as a goodwill gesture. Footnote number 24. Rabbi Essas was the third on a list that included famous refuseniks Joseph Begun and Ida Nudel, and thus the cheapest in Soviet eyes. Making it to such a list at all required the combined efforts of numerous parties exerting pressure from different directions. Lo dubim velo yar. There's as much truth to this paragraph as my telling you that in 1948 the State of Israel was declared by the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah of Agudat Yisrael. If you believe that, you can believe this. A list, take him, he's the cheapest. By the way, it has to be checked. I have a feeling Ethan Udell might have been here by the time Essas got out. It has to be checked. Yosef Begun doesn't get here until about 87, but it may be that Ethan Udell was here already. It has to be checked. Gentlemen, you heard this. You hear this, you see this, you read this. This is the Haredi world? This is the so-called black world? These people have Yiddishkeit? These people have Torah? These people have Tzidkeit? These people have Chesed? These people have intellectual honesty? I don't know. Many of the areas I just mentioned, they are sorely and solely lacking. But with all my complaints, and believe me, this hurts, because 100 years from now, they're going to hold this book and hold my book. I don't know who they're going to say is right. I don't know what they're going to believe. Thank God I saved every piece of paper. Malka used to laugh at me. Why do you need these pieces of paper? What are you saving it for? And wow, does my correspondence with Moshe Sherer and the documents and the correspondence with the senators and the correspondence with Bronfman, Izzy Singer, wow, at least I can prove my case. But with it all, I can be bitter, I can be upset, I can be complaining, I can be yelling, I can be shouting, but my Torah has to remain whole. I have to be a tzaddik and a gon. That's what I have to strive to be. I will not throw the baby out with the bathwater. I once dialogued with a very prominent American rabbi who shall remain nameless. He lives here today. And he has his problems. He was raised in a right-wing world. His wife was raised in an even a more right-wing world. And over the years, they both felt angry at the right wing for justifiable reasons many times. And they moved very left, extremely left. He's on the rabbinic board today of Chovevei Torah. That's a Chaim Berlin Musmach, a Chaim Berlin graduate. And a wonderful Jew, don't misunderstand me. And a big Talmud Chacham, don't misunderstand me. And he's entitled to his point of view. But we once dialogued in public, and I could see the bitterness coming out of him, and I got up and said, Rabbi so-and-so, no one has more complaints against the Haredi world than I do. I've lived in Israel at that time 35 years. Today it's 42 years. I've seen them up close. We eat chazer in Israel today because of Agudat Yisrael, and this is a fact. You can check it out. You remember when Begin, when it was introduced, outlawed the breeding of chazer by Jewish kibbutzim, and Mizra went crazy, and the pressure they put on Begin, and he came to Agudat Yisrael, and he bought them off. They withdrew the bill. Money for chinuch atzmai. I hope it went to chinuch atzmai. And these are facts. You can get to any newspaper. It has to probably about the early 80s. You can follow. And then the massive Russian immigration came. You try to outlaw chazer today, there'd be an outcry from here to Chovevei Torah in New York City. So I said, I know about Agudat Yisrael. I know about who they are. I trust, truth is, if I have a choice, I don't trust the Hekshah. Give me Eidah Haredit, give me OU, give me Machzikei Hadat, don't give me Agudat Yisrael. I don't trust the Hekshah. I've seen how much they have sold out of Yiddishkeit. There's always a price. And I'll tell you, I don't want to repeat what I heard from one of the biggest rebbeim in the world, Chinuch Atzmai, Daf Leiden. I don't see any great achievements out of Chinuch Atzmai either. Believe me, I saw so many kids grow up in Chinuch Atzmai who were far, far from Shmirat Shabbat and all that's holy to us. Okay. But I'm not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I studied with the Rav. I spoke, as I mentioned, I knew Reb Moshe, I knew Reb Aaron, I knew Reb Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, I knew the Tzu Balka Rav, I knew the Shanghai crowd. I have a commitment to the past. And that past has to emblazon my future with Torah and understanding. And with all our complaints, we have to know where to draw the line. Swing to the right? Fine. No intellectual honesty? Fine. I have an obligation to be a gong and a tzaddik and to show them you can live in Israel and live in the modern world and walk forward with Torah arm in arm, in total understanding and consonance. Now, I mentioned last week about YU. People wonder why you swing to the right. Is there, isn't there? I'm not an expert on YU. I can only tell you about the Kollel, and the Kollel, as you know, is a small little shoot-off from YU, which really has no role to play on the greater YU scene as far as I can understand and see. But nevertheless, a lot has happened in YU. And there's no question that YU is affected by the general population, and sometimes you have an you have an inferiority complex.
You remember you used to say the Chumrah of the Week.
Chumrah of the Week, upmanship, call what you want. I call it an inferiority complex, that everyone wears a black hat, and all right. And to me, that's not a swing to the right. The black hat and the black and white dress is more an expression of Hasidus, that we belong to the club. That's not a swing to the right. A Talmud here, then he asked me, I told him on one level I do see a swing to the right. There's a very simple example. If someone came to the Rav and said, Rebbe, I'm interested in Chinese literature. The Rav would tell him, get a doctorate, become a professor. That should be your calling if you're interested. I need not tell you, one of the Rav's greatest Talmidim of the early 40s became the ranking professor of Irish literature in the United States. Yitzchak, you know who I'm talking about? Dr. Vogelander. Professor Vogelander. The ranking professor. The Irish government gave him all types of awards. You have no idea. And he's, I don't know how well he's
done.
Your
old Chavusa, Moshe Gold, his son, the Chaim Gold.
Chaim Gold.
His son Moshe, PhD from Columbia, and James Joyce.
James Joyce.
The Rabbinic sources of the James Joyce.
Okay. Fabulous. No, we don't have
to.
Rabbi Lichtenstein.
That's a doctorate.
So, now if a kid came to a Rebbe today, let the Rebbe remain nameless, one of the famous Rebbeim in YU. I'm pretty sure if he came to one of the famous Rebbeim in YU and says, Rebbe, I'm interested in Chinese literature. And the Rebbe would say to him, look, it's a difficult major. You'll have to devote many hours. You don't have that much time for learning. Better take a simple major. Why don't you do like Rakefet, study Jewish history? That's a simpler major. Now see, there you can see this swing to the right. If someone came to the Rav and said, Rebbe, why do I have to study general studies? The Rav would say, look, you're a citizen of the world. You're a toshav. You have to understand contemporary society. Today, someone comes to a Rebbe, why do I have to study math? So you should make a living. You should have panasa. It's so different on that level. I always love to tell the story with the Rav, and this happened a number of times. It repeats itself. Well, one time it happened when I was a Rebbe in the yeshiva already, and students were complaining they're teaching the kids Greek mythology. I think it was in the high school. So I told the kids, you have a complaint? Go downstairs to Rabbi Finkelstein. He was Mr. Abrams' assistant, George Finkelstein, and George will set up a meeting with you and the Rav. George is close to the Rav, and take your complaints to the Rav. So these kids go, the Rav meets with them, and he lets them have it. He says, don't you want to be educated? Don't you want to understand Western civilization? Don't you want to understand where you live? These are the roots. You're going to leave the yeshiva. You're going into a big Western world. You're leaving the ghetto. You won't be cloistered. You have to understand the roots of civilization. And it's very important that you know Greek mythology. The kids were disappointed. I can only tell you, after studying Greek mythology 50, 60 years ago, it's the greatest thing I ever learned. I'll tell you why. Take a look. What is Greek mythology? Greek mythology, look at the gods. The gods, they're murderers. They're robbers. They're thieves. They're rapists. They're seducers. Tell me, what is Western civilization? Look at the gods. Look who was president of the United States, Bill Clinton. All right? Do we have to go any further? Monica, Jennifer, the president of the United States, ran away to escape the draft, took drugs, pushed drugs in college, self-admission. Where are we at? Look at Israel. Look at some of the scandals we have had here. Take a look who's going to jail. I don't have to elaborate. The president, the prime minister. Hashem Yerachem. What do we have? But Elu Elohecha Yisrael. When you understand Greek mythology, you can understand democracy. You can understand who the people vote for. Could you imagine Rakefet is running against Barak? Who's going to vote for Rakefet? Who is the guy? He sits and learns it and goes to the cocktail. All right, Barak, you understand, color throughout his wife, marries a floozy. He ran away, ran around with when he was in the army. The stories that come out here about our leaders, you're living already in a good time. You don't know what it was like when I came in Ali. You heard of Moshe Dayan? You don't even start to know the stories of Moshe Dayan. on Rehov Chernichovsky, around the corner from me. They showed us already in 69. I found out it was absolutely true. 68, a kid came home from high school, found his mother, I don't want to go further, and the guy had a patch over one eye. The kid committed suicide. You understand? Everyone knew who has the patch. The story with the meeting of the ministers, of the joke that went around Israel, that someone ran in, Golda Meir was then prime minister, and they said, Golda Meir, one of your senior members of the cabinet with a patch over one eye, he was doing this, this, this. She screamed, bring him in, I'll take out the other eye. All right, but this is Greek mythology come to life. I always think of the Rav. You want to know the foundations of Western civilization? Absolutely fabulous. Study Greek mythology. But I will not throw the baby out with the bathwater. And just the opposite. I have to be an example so that one day the people that read Rabbi Shera, the people that grew up in this world, will look at my world and my students and my family and say Kezer Re'ei V'Kadesh. And I want to add one postscript. I don't want to mention names here.
Once you don't drop it entirely.
I want to add one postscript. And B'didi HaVeYovda, it involves everything we spoke about today, the people involved. So our good at Israel started working in Russia, and you know, when they met people like Rakefet, like Rubin, like the 200 plus people my wife and I spent, just think how much the Israeli government put into this, and you don't realize what it meant to send some of that. I go through a security check first. Wasn't simple. A fortune of money was spent preparing them, checking if they could go, preparing them to go, and the whole trip and the money that was sent. I went the second and third times with endless thousands of dollars that had to be spent here and had to be spent there, had to be given to this one, had to be given to that one. And it was just unbelievable what the government put into all this. So I got Agudat Yisrael involved. Of course, Agudat goes with the Shita. There's only one way, we're the right way, and they go with the Shita. Very simple. From communism, you came to Zionism. From Zionism, you came to Judaism. And from Judaism, you came to Agudat Yisrael, which is the ultimate goal. And they quote Nathan Birnbaum, if you know your Zionist, Agudat history, Nathan Birnbaum was a great Zionist. He coined the term Zionism. He was one of the aides-de-camps of Theodore Herzl. And our friend Nathan Birnbaum lived a long life and became a total Agudist, denied Zionism, but he has great schut. His grandson is Jacob Birnbaum, should only live and be well. He's an old man today. You don't know who Jacob Birnbaum was. I mentioned the name. You should stand up. He was the first Jew to yell and shout, let my people go. Columbia University knocked on doors, and then he got Glenn Richter, an organized SSSJ, but Jacob Birnbaum was the father of the movement. Glenn Richter becomes the executive director. And who would ever dream, I have to tell you, when you speak about the Jewish people past World War II, the miracles are tangible. The State of Israel, the Israeli army, the reawakening of Russian Jewry. So I got Agudat Yisrael involved. You can read all the details in my new book, Be'ezrat Hashem. And they had influence. They sent in great people. They sent in people from all over, Switzerland, England, America. Once they were involved, they were involved. They sent in Seifrim, they sent in Rosh Yeshiva. And as I said, the longer a person stayed in refusal, the more he went from communism to Zionism to Judaism to Agudat Yisrael's gestalt. So one family gets out. You have no idea how much pain there is in this story for me personally. Here was a kid that Rabbi Teitz was the sandak at his bris. Again, some of you know that Rabbi Pinchas Teitz of Elizabeth retained and Rabbi Arthur Schneier, his father of New York City, retained proper relations with the communist so-called religious authorities, quote end quote. And they could occasionally go behind the Iron Curtain, and everything was in the open and public, nothing was done clandestinely. And this kid, the Sundik and his Brit, the Mole was a Chabadnik, and the Sundik was Rabbi Pinchas Teitz of Elizabeth. So this kid comes to Israel before Bar Mitzvah, and I arrange for the kid to go to Chorev. It takes pool to get a kid into Chorev. It's an outstanding school, and it was filled. But the principal, Shlomo Merzel, I had sent to Russia. The minute I called him, the kid was there. Father gets out. Chorev is not firm enough. Chorev is Zionistic. It's not what Rav Hirsch had in mind, the Chmeis, at the time when he organized the original Chorev in Frankfurt. The kid goes to Chayda, not even Chinuch Atzmayim, at the kid's bar mitzvah. I was overwhelmed. The whole group of kids come in with their Rebbe. Men are in one room, women in another room, and they're speaking Hebrew. I thought they were speaking Yiddish. Outside, if they're not speaking Yiddish, I could have believed I was in Poland in the year 1905. And the Rebbe, and the Rebbe Rett, and the kids, and the pay of this. All right. Entitled freedom of choice. I sat there. What'll be with this kid? I got a call from the parents 3 years later. Kid woke up, 16 years of age, said to his parents, "You destroyed me, you ruined me. I have no way to make a living. I have no general knowledge whatsoever." The kid, within a year, left home. Never came back. Went into the army, lives in Tel Aviv, never married. I doubt if he fasted on Yom Kippur. So I just want to tell you, if you think that salvation is in this type of Yiddishkeit that is presented in this volume, you are very wrong. Baruch
you
Hashem.
You left out some information about Mr. Esau.
What?
My focus with
Polanski. You want to get the class involved in everything
well,
that wanted in Russia?
It was not a great Sonic if you made.
Yeah, say that so they'll take their side from the Machloikin. And I want to tell you, I have a line in my book. The first time we came to Russia, there was no Machloikin. The second time we knew we had succeeded, there was Machloikin. That's a sign of the Jews. Baruch Hashem. It was five times the crowds from 1981 to 1985.
I met him in the subway. He was very vehement about
we know
maintaining
that. But he, for him, it was a machloket l'shem shemayim, because a guy divorces his wife and runs off with a goyish student and converts. You understand? It's not so simple. It's not so simple.
What did Pinchas Polanski end up doing?
Not Pinchas Polanski. Dyshinsky. It was his father. The Machlokes was with Pinchas Polanski. No, it was with his friends, Kyra Ivanov's father-in-law, Professor Dyshevsky. I have all these names in the book, actually. So that's whom the Machlokes was with. The end of the Machlokes is very simple. They all remained from Jews. And they've all made major contributions to the Russian Torah community, Alat Matah Kodesh. And nevertheless, here you have one story of a drop away, and Yehuda can tell you another story where they become Chabatnikim and go crazy. So you see, in life, you don't win it all. But no one could ever convince me that being right-wing, they have a higher percentage. We lose at times, and they lose at times. And somehow when they lose bigger than when we lose. That much I can tell you. I've seen that more than once. I haven't seen too many of our losses posing naked for pornographic pictures. I've seen Geren Satma Chassidiyot, Loa Lane, you can't look at the pictures. Okay, gentlemen, to reiterate. All right, I made a fool out of myself today.
Nope.
What do you say, David? It was worth 99 grand to see the Rebbe slap his face. I may be right, I may be wrong, but the facts are on my side. Gentlemen, I have not ended yet. Next week, I want to show you documents and deal with Masorah and add a twist to all that you read in the latest Jewish Action, and I want to show you that Solomon Schechter's thinking was absolutely right. And I will show you how I apply it and how that to me is the key to all the problems that we are facing today on the greater American Torah scene. Gentlemen, to reiterate, what did we do today? Oh, I have one more thing I have to mention. Rabbi Gil's student, who's a very bright and a very inceptive individual, really understands life and the world. I give him all the credit. So he heard the tape where I spoke about YU and I let off steam about how they face Amsterdam Avenue when they daven. So he tells me how he thinks it began. When I entered YU in 1990, Rav David davened diagonally, directly into the corner, rather than facing the wall of the RM.
There's a wall there.
Yeah, but is it the wall of the Aaron Kodesh?
No, no.
So that's what he's saying. I don't know when or why he changed, but all of Talmidim in my day imitated him. Then he writes, Rabbi Schechter actually swung that minion to the left. Rav David had the minion say both Tachnun and Halal Yom Atzmut and Slichat Ambahab. Rav Schechter is now the Rav of that minion and has them skip Tachnun and Slichat and Yom Atzmut. And again, he says Halal. So that's what he means, swung them to the left, that they're more like me, let's say. Okay, swung them. I don't like that term left, but now I understand. Now, what does he mean that Rav Schechter is the rabbi of the minion? What minion are we talking about? Isn't this the main minion? Okay. In my time, all the Rosh Yeshiva davened up front, and I don't even know whether Rav David davened there. You know, it dawns upon me, there was a minion in room 101, a Sephardic minion that davened Nusach Sfrad, but it faced Amsterdam Avenue. That minion, I remember Rav David davening. I remember Rav Weiss was the Rav of that minion. And I don't recall, you know, I have to think, did I ever see Rav David in the Big Beit Medrash? But one thing I can tell you, I never saw any Rosh Yeshiva, any Rebbe, face Amsterdam Avenue. They all faced straight ahead.
Why Rav David in the
Maybe because it faced Amsterdam Avenue.
It's
yeah.
complicated, but they point out that there is a plaque that's saying Rav David davened here.
Yeah.
They put it, but it's booked. But Manhattan is at an angle. So if you face Amsterdam Avenue, you're really not facing east either. You're facing south.
So you mean even
so
if
there's a wall in the base medrash, supposedly exactly east, and that's what he used to stand in.
All I can tell you is that the Achronim all discussed the Shiloh, and many felt you had to daven facing the Aron Kodesh. That b'diavad, any way you daven, it ultimately reaches Israel, because it depends.
Round,
right, the world is round, exactly. Gentlemen, we did today the Rabbi Sherer book. Next week we continue. We're almost at the very end. Sunday, Be'ezrat Hashem, we start off with suicide. Sunday is most fascinating until we meet again in health and happiness. Das v'danya.
I have to tell you. I was in Kiev. You know that story.
Nothing, that's for you.
I want to buy the book.